Hey, folks, you're listening to a free version of the Ring of Fire radio podcast. Now, this is just an hour long. If you want the full show, you got to sign up to become a member over at rofpodcast.com. Why would you become a member? Well, first off, you get the full show without commercials. Plus, you get the archives of this program going back years upon years. I don't know how many years it is, maybe 5 or 6 years, maybe more. So you can hear interviews with some great thinkers, some great writers, some great journalists throughout the years, completely free, part of your membership. And on top of all this, not only do you get great content every week, 3 hours commercial free, not only do you get complete archives, you also support this program and keep it on the air. So when you become a member of the Ring of Fire radio podcast, you support the free show and you support the show that goes out to terrestrial radio, about 50 stations across the country. Folks, we need your help. Radio business is not what it was. In fact, it's barely a business anymore. So this is where we get our revenue. By becoming a member, you help keep us on the air and fighting back against the corporate narrative that you hear every day on your cable news or your radio, and also to make sure that you know the most you can about what's going on with this administration. Thanks so much. Welcome to Ring of Fire Radio. I'm Sam Cedar. Today on Ring of Fire, Sharon Block, former Obama official from the National Labor Relations Board, will be here to explain how Donald Trump is turning back the clock on labor rights. Investigative reporter Marshall Allen will be back to discuss his latest ProPublica piece, The Myth of Drug Expiration Dates. Eliza Carney from the American Prospect will talk about her piece detailing the misguided purpose of Donald Trump's Presidential Advisory Commission on election integrity. And Heather Digby Parton from Salon.com will be here to help boil down what was a very busy week in the news. Folks, don't forget, you can go to rofpodcast.com and sign up for the Ring of Fire radio podcast. You'll have two options to help support the show: sign up for the free podcast or become a member and receive the full show without commercials, plus bonus content you won't hear anywhere else. That's rofpodcast.com. Here to help me analyze a very interesting and busy week in the news, Heather Parton from Salon, or as you may know her from her blog, Hullabaloo, Digby. So, Heather, another week, insane week in the Trump era of U.S. politics. I don't know, frankly, if we'll ever return to a different time. I think returning is out of the question. We just go forward as we see norm after norm fall by the wayside, and really just it's lunacy. I mean, we're living in an era now where the sort of just the absolute, just it's nutso stuff. And you know, let's dig into it. Let's start first with the healthcare bill, the attempts to repeal and replace. It went on this week, and it started, I guess the week started, with Republican lawmakers having no idea what they were going to vote on. And John McCain in Arizona, where on, I believe it was on Monday, or I mean, maybe, I guess it was last week, but John McCain, having gone through surgery because he has brain cancer, and people wondering whether or not he was going to head back for a vote on. The first vote was going to be this motion to proceed, which we should say, well, I don't know, you know, why don't you take it from here a little bit? There's so many different intertwined stories. Let's start, let's put McCain to the side for a moment, if we only could, and talk about What was Mitch McConnell's challenge going into that vote for the motion to proceed, which allows basically the process of debate and then a series of votes on different bills to begin?
Well, I think the last time we spoke, I think we had, it's so hard to keep up because this saga just kind of continues. But I believe that we were talking about the fact that McConnell had hit a wall and that it was clear that they did not have the votes to proceed with their repeal and replace bill. I think it's the BCRA.
Right, the Better Care Replacement Act.
Replacement Act. And that they didn't have the votes for that. It was clear that this was not going to work. We talked about this. It was interesting because it kind of reflected the full, every faction in the Republican caucus in the Senate, from the libertarians to the moderates, to the extent there's that much difference. But, they were sort of represented in this group that was saying they weren't going to vote for it. So it seemed at that moment that we had reached a point where McConnell had nowhere to go, and he sounded very depressed about it. But he didn't give up, and they decided to, set forth this idea that they could do the repeal and replace, just put the original Obamacare repeal vote to the Senate again, and maybe kind of mau-mau some of these senators who'd voted for it in the past and say, hey, how come you changed your mind? This was the vote that President Obama had vetoed. So they thought, okay, well, maybe we can do that. And then they decided beyond that maybe, and this sort of came out early in the week, that they could do this skinny repeal, which basically that is just sort of a shell piece of legislation that they could then use to go to conference, and Paul Ryan and Mitch McConnell and their leadership cronies could cobble together something that they hoped they could get both the House and the Senate to sign on to. So what they needed to do was to decide to proceed with this series of votes and various amendments and a number of things that could get them to this point where they would have a bill that they could take to the conference, knowing that the bills that they had previously put out there were not going to pass. And I know this is confusing, and I'm sorry, but it is confusing, and for a reason, because nobody knew what was going on. The senators didn't know. And as Senator Richard Burr of North Carolina said, I don't care what it is, I'm going to vote yes. That was basically the position of 95% of the Republican Senate caucus. They didn't care what it was. They were going to vote yes. But that, they have a very slim majority, so they needed to do something to get over the hump so that they could get Mitch McConnell and Paul Ryan into a room together to try and figure out how to put something together. So that's where we were on this motion to proceed, which was just to allow this process to go forward. And that brings us then to John McCain.
Well, before we get to John McCain, we should also talk a little bit about what happened with the parliamentarian, which slipped my mind here. But the course of the weekend, the parliamentarian, and this is going to get a little weedy, folks, but this is what's going on here. The Republicans know they can't pass anything if they need any Democratic votes. So they've had to pursue this reconciliation process, not to be confused with the attempts of the House and the Senate leaders in conference to reconcile their bills. Separate things. Separate things. The reconciliation process allows them to pass legislation that specifically has to do with the budget with only a simple majority, 51 votes. However, there are restrictions and definitions as to what constitute having to do with the budget. And that is known as the Byrd rules. And the parliamentarian determines whether or not elements of a bill comport with the Byrd rules. And it turns out a whole host of things in that bill did not comport with the Byrd rule, including Planned Parenthood defunding, including the insurance paying for abortions, but also, and very important to the function of this entire plan, they had a provision, because they want to get rid of the mandate, which basically said you have to wait 6 months before you get insurance if you decide to get insurance, so that you would get rid of the free rider plan, you know, problem where someone decides like, oh, I'm sick, I'm going to go buy health insurance. And then all of a sudden, only sick people buy health insurance, which, of course, insurance can only function if both people who are sick and people who are healthy buy it and don't know who's who, right? I mean, it would be the functional equivalent of like only buying fire insurance as you run out of your burning house. And only those people whose house was on fire bought fire insurance, the insurance wouldn't work. Well, the parliamentarian said this is not, it does not impact the U.S. budget in any way. And so you can't vote on this. And this is going to be very, very important when we talk about what comes out of that conference between Ryan and McConnell. But we will talk about that, and we will talk about John McCain's theatrics in just a moment when we return. I'm Sam Cedar. This is Ring of Fire Radio. We're talking to the great Digby, and we will be back in just a moment. Folks, the Ring of Fire is sponsored by JustCoffee.coop. That's JustCoffee.coop. If you like fair trade, delicious coffee, tea, or chocolate, head over to JustCoffee.coop, use the coupon code MAJORITY, and get 10% off. There's free shipping. You have no reason not to get this great coffee. It's a great outfit in Madison, Wisconsin, which supported the protests there. JustCoffee.coop. Welcome back to Ring of Fire Radio. I'm Sam Cedar here with Heather Digby Parton from Salon. So, Digby, when we broke, we were beginning to retell the story of this week, or just one part of the story from this week. And we basically had gotten as far as Mitch McConnell holding the motion to proceed vote on Tuesday, which was to be followed by a series of votes on various proposals, including the original underlying bill, the Better Replacement Better Care Replacement Act, and a vote on the 2015 measure, the just basically clean repeal, which we should remind people, members, Republican members of the House and Republican members of the Senate both voted for and passed, but was, of course, vetoed by Barack Obama back in 2015. That also failed. And then on to the so-called skinny repeal, which was just a couple of measures that could meet the Byrd Rule muster and were really inconsequential, just a shell, like you said last segment, to get Mitch McConnell and Paul Ryan in a room and hammer out a bill that would then go back to the separate houses and they would vote on, and it would be an up or down vote. And I don't know where you are on this, Digby. I mean, obviously it's very, it's a scary proposition because this bill is a mess by any measure. I mean, forget about politics, just like it's the sheer mechanics of it is a disaster for the health insurance industry. But I'm quite convinced that the Republicans are likely to pass this.
Oh, you know, I have, to be honest, I've always thought that they were likely to pass this. I mean, I guess you never know, and clearly it's been up and down and back and forth, and it's a zombie that just keeps coming back and back when it seems as if it's dead. But look, they are in a position for the first time in many years where they've got a president, well, he's not even a president. He's just a pen with a hand attached to it when it comes to legislation, who will sign anything they give him. They know that. And this may be their last and only chance to repeal Obamacare and you know, just have it passed. They can do their celebration, move on to their tax cuts and whatever else these great white whales of their agenda that have been out there that they just want to take care of. It is almost impossible.
Let me just say, I don't think that white whale is the repeal of Obamacare. I think it's the cutting of Medicaid,
of course,
and the subsequent tax cuts. Go ahead.
Absolutely.
I'm sorry. Yeah.
Absolutely. And that is, you know, the stuff about the exchanges and the rest. I mean, of course they want to get rid of that too. Don't kid yourself. I mean, if they don't want any of Obamacare, but it's that Medicaid money that they want to get to, and they want to once and for all be able to get rid of Medicaid altogether, to the extent that it will even exist after they do this. I mean, this is a lot of money they're stripping out, and it's not just the Medicaid expansion. They went after the underlying Medicaid program in their BCRA and in the House version. This is truly what they want, and they want to be able to get those tax cuts to their rich donors and be able to say that they have accomplished this one thing. Degrading the, quote, entitlement system is, you know, I mean, this is basically what these people are all about. That this is the fundamental driving force of their domestic agenda, and has been, by the way, for, you know, 40, 50 years. Beyond that, even. Social Security is still out there, and they'd love to get their hands on that, too. I mean, this is just what they live for. So, you know, it's always been very hard for me to see why in this position that they would do this. And by the way, Sam, I don't think if McConnell, I mean, the House, I think they can probably strong arm their people into doing whatever they want. I honestly think they can probably do that. The Senate is a little bit tougher, but Mitch McConnell has a nuclear option at the end of all this. He can bust the filibuster if he wants to. I mean, no, he doesn't want to, because he thinks that he can, you know, that it may be useful to him at some point down the road. And, you know, it is a very, very, it's a very bold action for him to take. But he could do it. And if that's what it takes, I honestly think he'll do it.
Now, let me just explain to people why he might have to do that. Because if they go into conference with each other, the House Republicans and the Senate Republicans, the Senate Republicans are showing up with basically an empty vessel, right? There's no bill to really speak of. The House is coming up with a fully formed bill, and it's like any type of negotiation, right? They always say your lawyer should draft the contract, because whoever drafts the first contract sets the table. So what comes out of that is going to look a lot more like the House bill than the Senate bill, because the Senate bill is barely anything. And the House bill will not conform, almost definitionally. They will never vote for something that would not defund Planned Parenthood or would allow for insurance to pay for abortion. And so that bill that comes out is not going to comport with the Byrd rule, so it won't be able to go through the normal reconciliation process. He will either have to do one of two things. He'll have to destroy the filibuster, or he'll have to overrule the parliamentarian, basically pull the nuclear option. And these things are, for all intents and purposes, very similar. I mean, they're not exactly similar, but for intents and purposes, they're similar. And I agree with you. I think that Mitch McConnell has already talked to a dozen plus senators, maybe more in his caucus, about this eventuality. He has to, because if you and I can see this end game so clearly, he must too. But look, we got to take a break. We got a lot more to talk about this. We got to talk about John McCain's role in this whole thing and why Mitch McConnell and Paul Ryan are driven by the same fervor that Jeff Sessions is in him staying in his job. We got to take a quick break. We'll be back with more Ring of Fire Radio, and Digby will join me in the next hour. I'm Sam Seder. This is Ring of Fire Radio. When we come back, former member of the National Labor Relations Board, Sharon Block, will be here to explain how Donald Trump is turning back the clock on labor rights. I'm Sam Seder. This is Ring of Fire Radio. I know the score.
trial lawyer, I've spent countless hours poring through documents that tell the story about the ugliest side of corporate America.
Fraud.
Corporate media refuses to talk about these issues.
The conduct by this company was deplorable.
I'm going to paint a clear picture about how disturbing, how corrupt corporate conduct has become in modern America. These are stories that no one else can tell. I'm Mike Papantonio, host of America's Lawyer. Question more.
Welcome back to Ring of Fire Radio. I'm Sam Cedar. Up until this week, the National Labor Relations Board has been immune to any major changes by the Trump administration. But that all changed when Donald Trump announced two new Republican board members. Here to discuss Donald Trump's anti-labor policy and how Trump plans to take us back in time on labor rights, Sharon Block, the former Principal Deputy Assistant Secretary for Policy at the U.S. Department of Labor and Senior Counsel to the Secretary of Labor under the Obama administration. So, Sharon, I think people are fairly familiar with some of the more headline-making changes that the Trump administration and frankly, the Republicans in the House and the Senate are seeking. But there's of the myriad of things that the Trump administration can do without legislation, without any new statutory authority. It seems to me that, you know, and maybe the EPA is another area where there would be a rival, but in the field of labor, and the relationship between labor and management in this country, the National Labor Relations Board is probably the least covered and understood by Americans relative to the impact, the long-term impact it can have. I mean, just briefly, just tell us a little bit about how the National Labor Relations Board works, what its implications are, and then we'll talk about some of the things that the Obama NLRB did.
Sure, happy to. So the NLRB, the National Labor Relations Board, is, you know, one of the key pieces of the New Deal. It came into being, you know, in the 1930s, again, as a part of the New Deal. And, you know, a lot of Americans don't know that workers in this country actually did not have a right to join trade unions before the NLRA. So it's the statute that protects your right to join a union. It sets forth a process by which there are free and fair elections for workers to decide whether they want to be represented by a union in their workplace. It protects them from being discriminated against by their employers or retaliated against because they want to be a part of a union. You know, that is for people who are aware of the NLRB. That's usually the part they know. But there's another part of the law that's really important. And to be honest, as union density in our country shrinks, that is becoming more and more important. And that is that the NLRB also protects the rights of workers who are not in unions, but who want to stand together with their coworkers and have a voice in their workplace, even separate and apart from sort of a formal collective bargaining relationship. So if you just think that you are being treated unfairly in your workplace and you want to grab a couple of colleagues and express that opinion, because of the National Labor Relations Act, you can't be fired for doing that. You don't have a right to get necessarily what you ask for, but you have a right to have that voice. And again, as we now have, you know, upwards of 90% of the American workforce not in unions, that right, though, to still find solidarity, to still find that strength in numbers is really important. And is a part of what at least the Obama administration board wanted to ensure that the law developed to make that part of the law important too. But, you know, in talking about the importance of the first piece, that protecting the right to engage in collective bargaining, again, we've got a labor movement that has been so under stress and under attack. These protections that the board is given the mandate to enforce, you know, couldn't be more important now than ever before. Again, because there has been such an onslaught in terms of attacking the labor movement in this country.
So, I mean, and let's talk a little bit about what the NLRB did over the course of the Obama administration, because for a long time, it didn't have a full quorum. Is that right? Because they just weren't, the Senate wouldn't confirm anybody.
That is true. So the board was effectively out of business for a certain amount of time. They tried to, you know, when we had that Republican intransigence and the board was down to only two members, you know, those understanding that wasn't ideal, but not wanting to just turn their backs on all the people who need the protection of the board members at that time did try to continue to have the agency function. The Supreme Court eventually said that was not allowed. Then we got back into the beginning of the Obama administration, and again, we saw Republican intransigence in terms of confirming board members, and we were in peril of being in that situation again where the board wasn't going to be able to function, and that was what led President Obama to make recess appointments to the board in 2012. I happened to have been one of those recess appointees, which then led to another round of litigation that eventually wended its way up to the Supreme Court because there were folks who questioned the validity of those recess appointments. But again, those came about, you know, people have to remember the context in which the president took those actions was, you know, an explicit commitment on behalf of the Republicans that they were not going to confirm members of the NLRB, and the president didn't want to see those important protections become meaningless because the board wouldn't have been able to function.
And we should say, I mean, just as a side note, that case, that Supreme Court case that basically ruled on what constituted a recess by the Senate, ended up being a very often cited reason why Barack Obama could not seat Merrick Garland, right? I mean, my understanding is, you know, that the basically recesses were defined out of existence, more or less. I mean, that's just a bit of a side note, but it's part of this larger story that, you know, we're dealing with, even when we look at, you know, sort of the complaints of loss of regular order in the Senate, when we talk about healthcare this week. All right. So give us a sense, and we got a couple of minutes in this segment, before we break, but give us a sense of some of the major rulings that once there was a full complement of commissioners sitting on the National Labor Relations Board. Mm-hmm. Give us a sense of some of the key rulings that impacted labor under the Obama administration.
Sure. Well, I'll start with actually something that was fairly unusual for the board in that it wasn't a ruling in a case, but the board during the Obama administration did take on rulemaking and did reset the rules for running elections in which employees get the opportunity to decide whether they want to be represented by a union or not. And, you know, despite what many people, you know, people who have heard about these rules, it was not a radical rewriting of the rules, but it was really a streamlining. It to many of us struck as a sort of good government reforms of that election process to try to minimize litigation, to get elections to happen in a more streamlined fashion. And interestingly, some of the sort of calamity howling that you heard at the time that the board put those rules out about, you know, it was just going to upend the whole process and elections would be out of hand. In reality, what we've seen is that elections are happening a little bit more quickly, but there hasn't been a radical change in the outcomes of that election. So that's one really important thing that the Obama administration did, the Obama administration board did. Some of the important cases are
I'll tell you what, Sharon. Let's take a break, and when we come back, let's talk about some of those important cases and the rights that it protected for workers in this country, and they're ones that are directly under threat. I think moving forward under a Trump administration, and we'll talk about why that's the case. We're going to take a quick break. We're talking to Sharon Block and about her piece in Democracy Journal, Trump Taking Us Back in Time on Labor Rights. I'm Sam Cedar. This is Ring of Fire Radio. We're back on Ring of Fire Radio. I'm Sam Cedar. Right now I'm talking with Sharon Block, former senior counsel to the Secretary of Labor, about her piece in the Democracy Journal, Trump Taking Us Back in Time on Labor Rights. So Sharon, at the break, you had walked us through the history of the National Labor Relations Board and also some of the moves that the National Labor Relations Board undertook under the Obama administration. While it didn't have a full complement of seated, I guess, commissioners or members of the board, for much of it because of, or for part of it because of Republican obstruction, ultimately there was enough of a complement or a full complement to work on some protections for labor. What are those cases that made it to the National Labor Relations Board that are important to protecting labor rights, but you feel are under threat under a Trump administration?
Sure. Well, let's start with one that we know is very much under threat from both the Trump administration and from the Republicans in Congress. So there was a decision called Browning-Ferris Industries of California, which articulated the standard for when the board can hold employers what they call jointly liable for each other's labor practices. So it's when two companies, it set forth a standard for when two companies, their interactions with a group of employees are so intertwined that they are both responsible for what happens with that workforce. And this is a really critically important issue because of the changes that we've seen in business models, the increase in the use of subcontracted work and temporary staffing agencies adding employees into an otherwise traditional workplace, and the franchise relationships, although this decision, the Browning-Ferris decision, was limited to, or the facts in that case were about temporary staffing agency sending workers into a workplace and working alongside traditional employees. So this is—it's just a really important decision in terms of ensuring that the National Labor Relations Act keeps up and adapts to the way the business models have changed, so that those rights are still relevant. We know Republicans have been talking about trying to undermine this decision for a long time. They had on the House side, the Education Workforce Committee had a hearing on this issue in which they attacked the decision just last week or the week before. And then we expect to see tomorrow a bill introduced in the House that would, by statute, reverse this decision. So that's a really important one. We also
and
have...
So just to be, let me just be clear. Sure. Let me just, make sure that people understand why this is so important, is that if a firm wanted to avoid certain labor laws or regulations or responsibilities to its employees, it could theoretically outsource this stuff to a temp agency, or it could say, like, well, if I'm McDonald's, I could say, I got nothing to do with how McDonald's in Peoria hire their people. All we do is set their prices and give them their food and give them instruction. I mean, so this closes massive loopholes that have opened up because of changes in the labor force.
Exactly.
So what is the next thing that we got to be concerned about?
Sure. So the board also issued an important decision about this really growing, to my mind, troubling trend of employers requiring employees upon hire to give up their right to participate in class action lawsuits if something in that employment relationship goes wrong. And, you know, often these are presented to employees as a condition of employment. The employees can't really, I mean, how many people really feel like when they're getting hired, they have the power to negotiate with their employer. And so they're told, if you want to work here, you've got to sign away your right to ever participate in a class action. And so you have these instances where, you know, employers are engaging in wage theft, all kinds of practices across all employees, and the employees are put in a position of having to sue the employer to assert their rights one by one. They can't join together, and the economics of that are just, you know, impossible. And it hits low-wage workers especially hard, because to the extent that people generally pay lawyers, you know, a percentage of a recovery they get from a lawsuit, you're a low-wage worker, you know, it's very hard to find somebody and for it to make sense for you to pursue your case on your own. That's the point of class actions, again, so that people can be strong, you know, can be stronger when they're together. This is an issue that's now pending before the Supreme Court. It has, again, been one of those lightning rod issues for Republicans, and they've pursued it. Business interests have pursued this issue to the Supreme Court. The board has been fairly successful in the Court of Appeals in the court saying that this was a correct interpretation of the act, that part of having the right to act together is the right to be able to join a class action, and so that employers can't prohibit that kind of activity. But again, with the Supreme Court, you know, I think we're all very nervous about where this decision is going to end up. And the Trump administration really put their finger on the scale in a big way. The administration, the Obama administration, had supported the board's decision, and the Trump administration recently announced that they were changing sides. They are now on the side of employers in that case in the Supreme Court. And hopefully, the board will be able to, though, pursue their side of it on their own.
And listeners to this program are very familiar, I think, with the attempts of corporations to basically bar the doors to the courts, to people without means to get redress in other ways. And these arbitration clauses in contracts between management and labor, and frankly, between corporations and consumers, very problematic in that regard. All right, we got about a minute and a half left. What's one more that we should keep an eye on?
Sure. The decision in Columbia University, which gave graduate teaching assistants the rights to form unions. I think this is an issue that has frequently flip-flopped as the makeup of the board has changed, but I think this time would really be different for it to change because the facts on the ground have changed. There's just been a tremendous interest and success in organizing graduate teaching assistants across campuses, especially in reaction to, you know, conditions that they perceive as not really being advantageous to them, in order to have a more of a voice in those relationships. And I think we unfortunately will likely see a reversal of that decision. And then last, I would just flag there are a number of decisions that I tried to highlight in the democracy piece that were not as high profile, but just about trying to get the act to be relevant in the modern workplace, dealing with things like social media and access to email. And it's really, you know, critically important. The statute needs to evolve. Obviously, things are different now than they were in the 1930s, and really concerned that a Trump NLRB, which we'll likely see in the next couple of weeks, is really not going to value that kind of adaptation.
Indeed. Sharon Block, thank you so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Sharon Block was the Principal Deputy Assistant Secretary for Policy at the U.S. Department of Labor. and senior counselor to the Secretary of Labor under the Obama administration. You can read her piece, Trump Taking Us Back in Time on Labor Rights, at democracyjournal.com. When we come back, Heather Digby Parton will join us to talk about the Republican plan for permanent tax cuts. That's just ahead. I'm Sam Cedar. You're listening to Ring of Fire Radio. Don't forget, check out ROFpodcast.com to support the show.